Take your Bibles and find your way to Luke chapter 19. Luke 19. We're pausing a little bit here in our expository series through the book of Luke to give some focused attention on what is happening here in our Christian kind of liturgy calendar with Palm Sunday today and then Easter next week. Today is what is called Palm Sunday. And this is because it really is an emphasis of the biblical story of Jesus entering Jerusalem, and he does it amidst a crowd of shout of celebrations and people laying down palm branches in front of him as he enters the city. Palm Sunday is all about the fact of Jesus as King. Jesus as King. Now, I think for most of us in this room, the idea of Jesus as King is not a new or strange idea, something that you are probably well familiar with. You could say that Jesus is King, but the question is, do you understand what that means for your life of faith today? We might agree with that creed that Jesus is King, but what does it mean for your life of faith today? So what I hope to do in this sermon this morning on Palm Sunday is give us three pictures or reminders of what it means for us to have Jesus as our King. This is not an exhaustive picture by any means, so I don't want you to walk out and think that you have just seen in the totality of who Jesus is. That is not what's happening this morning in the sermon. But it is my hope that these three pictures would give you cause to celebrate and be filled with gratitude about having a King like Jesus. I really hope that this will put fresh wind in your sails and hope in your heart and confidence in your soul about the future we have together as a church family because we have a King like Jesus. And I want to begin by taking us to the scene that Patty just read for us where Jesus is traveling to Jerusalem. He's on the road. He's descending down into the city. He's drawing near and there's people gathering. And this scene here in verses 34 to 41, it shows us that Jesus is a King who weeps. Jesus is a King who weeps. This passage recounts the story of this triumphal entry, or so-called triumphal entry. People were laying down palm branches in front of him as he was riding in. And this, by the way, is kind of like a Jerusalem version of maybe like the red carpet being rolled out for him, these palm branches being laid down as he was entering the city. It was a sign of high honor and praise. But it was more than just a celebration. You see, this is what would be done for a king who would return home to a city after conquering an enemy. There would be the crowd would go out to receive him with celebration as he made this triumphal entry into the city, and they would show honor and praise and celebration for his conquest through these signs. You see, the Jewish people in Jesus' day had high hopes for what they wanted the Messiah to be, for who they wanted to see in Jesus. They wanted him to accomplish a great victory against Rome, and as a result, remove Roman rule and oppression from their lives. But notice what the kingliness of Jesus consists of here in this text. He's riding a donkey colt. Have you ever gone horseback riding? Maybe you've found like a ranch somewhere up in the mountains or somewhere, and you went horseback riding. I remember doing this, and I don't know if you ever have this anticipation of hoping they assign you with a good horse. Does that make sense, or am I just the oddball here? Right? Nobody's gone horseback riding? I'm trying to read faces here. I see yeses, okay? And have you ever had it where you see the line of horses and you're like, man, I hope I don't get that one. Because it just looks, I don't know, less than ideal, kind of old and worn out or tired or just boring or not majestic, not doesn't seem fitting for who you see of yourself, right? It's not your spirit animal, of how you imagine yourself astride the horse, galloping through the mountains. Well, here Jesus is on a donkey colt. This is the kind of thing that a horseback riding place would not even offer their guests because it would just be so, it would just diminish the whole guest experience, you know? This is what he's riding in on. It's not a mighty steed. And the crowd, there's this paradox here in the scene because the crowd is treating him like a celebrity, but he's not behaving like one at all. And he doesn't look like one either. In fact, if you look at verse 41, what he's doing when he gets near to the city is he's weeping. This is really awkward. Have you ever been around somebody who's just weeping? It just feels awkward, doesn't it? This kind of defies our expectations, by the way, of a leader or of a king, right? Somebody who we might want to be a leader or king in our life. It kind of defies maybe some of the expectations we might bring into that. Jesus doesn't seem very kingly here. But you see, the true kingliness that we all long for and that we want deep in our souls isn't someone who is macho and grandiose and bombastic. Isn't somebody who is just full of charisma. That's not what we want, not really. But we also don't want a king who is weak or bashful or timid either. You see, what we want, what we need as a king, we need someone who is strong and mighty, someone who can conquer enemies, but we also want a king who is simultaneously compassionate and tender and honest and true. We want a king who is both brave and kind. We don't want someone who is partly brave or somewhat brave and partly kind or somewhat kind. No, we need a king who is fiercely brave and fiercely strong and fiercely true, but who is also, and to the same degree, just as fiercely compassionate and fiercely kind and fully tender-hearted. But this combination of qualities seems impossible to find. But that is what we have been given in Jesus. The king we celebrate on this Palm Sunday is a king who weeps. So a question, have you cried this last week? Have you felt tears? And if so, I hope today you would find comfort knowing that you have a king who also weeps. Jesus is the one who said in Matthew 5, blessed, happy. Here's the paradox again of the gospel in the Christian life. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. There's a promise of comfort in these words of Jesus there in Matthew 5. And you might think, well, how is Jesus going to comfort? Well, Jesus knows how to provide comfort because he's uniquely qualified because he has wept himself. Our king doesn't stand far off looking at your grief and tears from the distance as if you're some kind of zoo exhibit and he's on the other side of the glass looking at what you're going to do next. No, he's in there with you. He doesn't give you lectures about your tears, but he comforts you from a place of knowledge because he knows what it is like to weep. So today on this Palm Sunday, we celebrate a king who weeps. He rides into the city on a donkey's colt. Not a celebrity-like figure, one who weeps. And this matters because this is all part of the big story of the world, God's story, something that is called the gospel. In other words, the story of the Bible shows us that because Jesus weeps, you and I can be comforted. Jesus brings us comfort because he wept on the cross in our place. He cried out to God the Father when he gave his life as a sacrifice and as a substitute for you and for me, and he did this so we could know the comfort of forgiveness and experience deliverance from the penalty and judgment that we deserve for our sin. You see, Jesus didn't come simply to liberate people from political oppression. That is what the people of his day wanted to see him do. But what good would it be if he had done that, right? What good would it be to rescue someone from physical oppression? It might be helpful for a day, a week, a month, a few years maybe. But if all you do is overcome political oppression or physical oppression, what about your personal oppression of sin and death? And a life that seems meaningless? What good would deliverance from some physical oppression be if ultimately you still die in your guilt and condemnation of sin and feel like your life was meaningless? You see, Jesus came to deliver us from something far more enslaving than political or physical oppression. Jesus came to deliver you from death. And he came in weakness as a man of sorrow, one who weeps. And he dealt with sin, because it's sin that brings death into your life. And he did this with tears when he saw the city, Tears in the garden when he prayed, tears on the cross when he cried out in anguish that you and I deserved, but he took for us. We have a king who weeps. But not only does Jesus weep, as we keep reading in Luke 19, we also learn that Jesus is a king who has anger. I thought it was a little too shocking to say we have an angry king. Because it's not descriptive enough. It's not nuanced enough. But we have a king who has anger. I'll put it that way. Verses 45 and 46 of Luke 19. He enters the temple and he begins to drive out those who sold, saying to them, "It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." What emotion seems to be present in Jesus there as he drives out these merchants from the temple area? Doug just mouthed anger. Thank you, Doug. Do you see anger there? Some of you may feel awkward, like, can I even admit that Jesus was angry? I think the most obvious emotion we see here, if we just take it as a plain reading, would be that we see anger. Some might say righteous indignation. And I'll give that to you, but that's just a flowery way of saying he's angry, sinlessly. Are you surprised to know that Jesus has anger? And by the way, this isn't the only time that Jesus has anger. In fact, I had a whole section in the sermon that I had to get rid of because it's just we don't have time. But in John chapter 11, when Jesus travels to Bethany and he's there with Lazarus's family. Lazarus has died and he's presented with a scene of just anguish and grief. And there's a couple of words, instances in that narrative that John records for us. And the Greek words that are there to describe the emotion of Jesus are vivid and sharp and so strong that it's almost like the translators are trying to tone it down a little bit. Because the words there are literally like, his nostrils were flaring with rage. That's kind of the words that are used there. And you can read that on your own. But this isn't the only time that we see anger in Jesus. And what's interesting here in Luke 19, in just a few verses, it's in the same story, right? He's entering Jerusalem, he gets there, he's in the temple, and then he's angry. We have a story of a king who weeps, but also a king who has anger. These simultaneously are coexisting. It's not like he goes from one mode, weeping Jesus, into kind of he finds a new, like, you know, in your car, you could put it in a sport mode. Jesus wasn't like going into the city kind of in weeping mode, and he gets over to the temple and he clicks it over into like anger mode. That's not what's happening here. He is fully and perfectly all of this. Why is he angry? Well, there's a few things in the story that help explain it. And I'm just going to go through some details. But one of the activities that happened in the temple, of course, we understand was sacrifices. If you read anything in the Old Testament, Leviticus, you'll be well acquainted with all of the things that had to go on with sacrifices. There were items that were necessary for these sacrifices to take place. And in a week like this, in this section where they're coming together to observe Passover, you'd have thousands of pilgrims that were traveling into the city to observe Passover. And part of that would have involved going to the temple and offering sacrifice. And so in order to do that, they had to provide these items that were necessary for people to do these sacrifices. If you were traveling a long distance, you wouldn't carry along with you your sacrificial animal, likely. It would have been too risky because it could have gotten sick or injured or harmed in some way in the travel, and then you wouldn't have an animal that you could sacrifice because the law required it to be blemish-free and perfect to be used. And so the law required that, and so as a result, there was this large and lucrative business that had developed in the temple area that was providing these items for sale so people could obey the law, obey God in these sacrifices. And you say, well, what's the problem? Well, providing those items necessary for these worshiping pilgrims in and of itself wasn't wrong. The problem is that when people arrived at the temple, it felt like they were at the mall, not like they were at a place of worship. What was wrong is that the commerce had taken over the temple, and the temple was supposed to be known as a place of prayer. You see what Jesus says in verse 46? Jesus is driving out these merchants, and he explains why. And we can only look at the first half. We don't have time to unpack what he means by a den of robbers. But he says, my house shall be a house of prayer. He's quoting from Isaiah, by the way. Jesus' statement teaches us something important about his anger. And I think I've mentioned this in the past, but what would you think the temple would be known as? Known as a place of what? Well, what came to my mind originally would have been sacrifices. I mean, that's where you go to do those things. You go to do sacrifices. But Jesus doesn't say it's a place of sacrifice. Jesus says that the temple was supposed to be known as a place of prayer. So you see, the temple was a place where people would go to meet with God. It's where the presence of God dwelled, which, by the way, it's rich and glorious to realize that in the New Testament, the New Covenant, we as God's people are now the temple where God's Spirit dwells. But in that Old Covenant, it was the temple, this physical location where the Shekinah glory of God was at, with the mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant. And so Jesus, what he's doing here is Jesus is telling us that relating with God, prayer, these are synonyms, relating with God, prayer, that was the big idea of the temple, not sacrifices. So hang in here with me, okay? I know we're getting, maybe it feels a little brainy, but these sacrifices, they were required. But they were reminders of what it takes to have a relationship with God. The sacrifices were not the end in mind. The sacrifices were done because what was the end in mind was relationship with God, drawing near to God, praying to God, communing with God. That's what was the big idea there. And in order to have a relationship with God, atonement for sin is needed. And so these sacrifices were a constant reminder, these actions, these events, these activities, the cost of the sacrifice too, of doing it, of buying an animal to sacrifice it, all of that was intended as a reminder of what is needed in order for you as a sinful person to have a relationship with a holy God. But the big important idea for the temple was not the sacrifices. It was the relationship with God. God drawing near to him in prayer, that would only be made possible through blood atonement. And so what we have here is Jesus is angry because something is hindering people from experiencing relationship with God. Something was getting in the way. Something is usurping that central importance of relationship with God. In other words, think of it this way. Jesus really wants you. Can I put it like that? He really wants you. He wants you to know him and to enjoy him. He asks for you to pray. He says, "Nah, ask and seek and knock. Don't be anxious, but pray. Cast all your cares on him. He cares for you. He wants you." And yet he gets angry then at anything that would stand in the way of your relationship with him. And by the way, that is a good thing. So have you been angry this past week? Have you had anger? I'm saying even a good anger here, okay? Have you had a good anger because something good or precious was harmed or damaged? Now here's the challenge for us as sinners. Our anger is often so full of our selfishness and sinfulness that it gets corrupted very quickly, doesn't it? But that's not true for Jesus. His anger is sinless. But that presents us with a bit of a conundrum, right? Because our anger is not sinless. Our anger is often full or mixed together with sin, with selfishness, and it's confusing, and it clouds us, and sometimes we can feel guilty then about being angry, and sometimes we should. And so I did a little reading or research about anger this week, and I wanted to share this a little bit with you just for some practical help for your own life of faith. Anger is a very complex emotion. It's elusive in a way. And that's because there are other emotions standing behind anger. Anger usually, it doesn't show up on its own. And for example, you might be angry because you are worried, or you're fearful, or frustrated, or you're hurt, or you're jealous, or you're lonely, or you feel betrayed. You see how these other emotions can stand behind and it appears in our lives as anger then? But also, we need to understand that anger is an emotion of action. And this is going to make sense here in a minute with Jesus. Just hang in here with me, okay? Anger is an emotion of action, which means that anger is not meant to simply remain in us. It's not sustainable for us just to have anger just brewing in us, like a storm just kind of stalled in our hearts. When you're angry, you want to do something. Anger is a catalyst. Holding on to anger will make you exhausted. It'll make you sick internally. Sometimes we try to respond to anger by internalizing it, which is just meaning we bury it, but that's going to take away joy. And externalizing anger or lashing out, kind of unrestrained lashing out, that can make you work against creating positive change, and it often hurts relational connection. So in other words, anger is an emotion that needs to be transformed into something else, some sort of action. Life-giving, like courage, or love, or change, or growth, or compassion, or justice. It's meant to drive something good. Often, though, in us, as sinners, it drives something bad. But not so for Jesus. And here's how I want you to see the beauty of what we have in Jesus as a king who has anger. Because what does Jesus do in his anger? He does something. Do you see it? He removes the things that stand in the way of knowing him and enjoying him in relationship. He's elevating their priority of knowing him and enjoying him in relationship. And so here in the temple, he throws out the money changers. And later on the cross, he throws out sin and death. And I hope you find comfort today knowing that Jesus gets angry because he loves you. He wants you. His anger is an anger of what would stand in the way of knowing him, and so he's relentless in pursuing you. His anger and his love will find you. That's the gospel. And see, Jesus didn't just throw out the merchants because he was upset that he wasn't getting a cut of it. Or he thought, man, they got a good idea. I'm going to be competition. I'm going to do my own thing. It wasn't selfish at all. It was selfless. It was done so that people could be brought close to God. And Jesus throws out sin. You know how he does it? By atoning for it with his own lifeblood. And Jesus throws out death. How does he do it? By turning his death into a resurrection and then offering that resurrection life to everyone who is united to him in repentant faith. This is the king we have. We have a king who turns death into resurrection. In John 11, that's where his anger was at. His anger in John 11, when with the tomb of Lazarus, he sees the grief of the death and he is angry. And it says, and then when he went to the tomb, he says, take me to the tomb. And Mary and Martha are like, you shouldn't go there. It's going to stink. He's been dead for days. And Jesus says, no, take me there. And so it says as he walked up to the tomb, it says that he was like snorting in rage as he walked to the tomb. Which makes me think that when he said, Lazarus, come out, it wasn't just this meek little, Lazarus, are you in there? Come out. Knock, knock. But I imagine that he bellowed that in rage at death. And he has come to remove it. Because he loves you. And well, I have one more vignette of Jesus to show us today. One more picture of the king that we celebrate on this Palm Sunday. And it's found in John 13. Can you find your way there? John 13. If a Bible is new for you, you are in Luke right now, maybe. And you just need to turn over to a next gospel. Because our gospels go in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the next one is John. And then the big numbers in your Bible are the chapters, and the little numbers are verses. And find your way to the big number 13, and that is where we will be this morning as we finish up. John chapter 13. I'm going to read verses 1 through 5 just to recover where we are at, since it was a while since we had read that. It says, now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. So we have a king who weeps. We have a king who has anger. And number three, Jesus is a king who loves us to the end. He loves us to the end. This passage is well known, right? It's famous. If you're a Christian for a while, you've probably read this passage, heard it, and have been inspired by it. But it's about feet washing. Yuck. I don't think if we had a foot washing station that our greeters, you know, manned each Sunday morning, I don't imagine that would help with our guest care for us or for our guests. It's just something kind of gross. And so I want you to soak in this in today, in verse 1, right? We're kind of focused on the foot washing, and we'll see that in a minute, right? There's an intended effect here. But the truth I want us to soak in today is found in verse 1. And it's in John's language here, it's kind of this long, you see how many commas are in there? This long kind of drawn-out sentence trying to pack all this information to make this whole scene very significant. He says, Jesus knew his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father. What if you knew you were going to live for one more hour? And you were going to die a tragic death? Humiliated at the hands of an executioner. I'm not saying what if you knew you were going to die peacefully in your sleep in an hour. But what if you knew in an hour, let's say 5 hours, okay, let's span it out. An hour might be too easy. What if you knew in 5 hours, because it's more than an hour, it's further an hour away here for Jesus. But what if you knew in 5 hours' time, in 8 hours' time, you would die an anguished death in a humiliating way? How much emotional bandwidth would you have for others? How generous might you find yourself to be? How compassionate with your spouse or your children or your mother or father-in-law might you be? But there's more here. He says, he knew the suffering and the sorrow of his crosswork was imminent. He knew he would die soon. He knew he would be forsaken as our sin sacrifice. And in that place of dread, John tells us that Jesus, do you see that at the end of verse 1? He loved them to the end. If anyone had an excuse, kind of a, hey, just give me a pass. Just give me a pass here, guys. But that's not Jesus. That is not the king we have. I want you to dwell on that statement, that he loved them to the end. What would you imagine that would mean for you? To be loved to the end. Maybe you have experienced a love that fell short of that. Maybe you feel like you're not worthy of being loved like that. Or you think it might be impossible for you to experience a love like that because maybe your experience in life has proven that that kind of love just doesn't exist. Or maybe you think it doesn't exist for you. He loved them so fully that no part of the love was left unfinished or lacking. Have you ever eaten a great meal and it was just so good and you felt so full that you just had to leave a few bites left? There are no bites of the love of God left on the plate for you. And notice when Jesus loves them to the end. I've already brought this up, but I just want to paint a fuller picture. But this happened. And John points that out. He makes these commaed phrases are packed in this description, but he's surrounded by someone who would betray him ruthlessly. He's near someone who would deny him repeatedly, and the rest of them would abandon him. And Jesus loves them to the end. He knows that the Father had given all things into his hands. And we kind of read that and go, yeah, whatever. But friends, in other words, Jesus knows he has the authority. He knows that he has the status. He has the rank of divinity. And he has all the might and all the power and all the sovereignty. And yet, he doesn't use those realities for himself. He does not take, he gives. He gets up and he takes a towel and he prepares himself to serve. And he chooses to serve in a way that was shocking to those that were with him. In fact, as you keep reading, Simon Peter verbally objects strongly and says, "This is not going to happen." And Jesus says, "It must." And so I was doing some reading about this. Foot washing was something that seemed only relegated to slaves. In fact, foot washing was so demeaning that some historical sources say that only non-Jewish slaves would do it. It was so demeaning. If someone did wash someone else's feet, that was a Jew with a Jew, maybe sometimes in families between spouses, if that did happen, what would often be the case is that happening would be a demonstration of extreme devotion from that person because it would have been so demeaning. But Jesus washes his disciples' feet. It was unprecedented because there is no record of ever anyone with a higher status ever washing the feet of those beneath them. It just didn't happen. And yet this is exactly what Jesus does. So the king we celebrate today on this Palm Sunday is a king who, when he's surrounded by people who lacked, when the relationships that were nearby him felt empty or duplicitous, what does he do? He serves. Knowing he has all the power and authority, he doesn't use that position or power to take. Instead, what he does is he gives. He doesn't come from a place of that weakness, and he doesn't exploit those around him for his own gain. No, he doesn't use others for his own satisfaction. No, he takes the enormous pressure on him, and it doesn't cause him to break trust. Instead, he loves them to the end. He serves. This is the king that we have. Now, being loved to the end like this is what is called true love. I debated on even talking about it as true love because I don't know if you were thinking of maybe some weird movie lines about true love or some ridiculous fairy tales about true love. But friends, this is true love. And when a person experiences a love like this, it transforms them. People will do crazy things for love like this. We can't stop writing songs about this idea. Or poems about this idea. Or stories about this idea. We just cannot stop it. People will try to crawl out of their own skin or gnaw off their own arm, as it were, to experience a love like this. And if people think they've found a leader who can lead them to a place of love or utopia like this, they will do crazy things in the name of love. In fact, I mean, we have stories where people will commit suicide en masse if they think they've found a leader that will lead them into a true love like this. And that's what the leader asks them to do. It's shocking in a way, isn't it? That's the power of a love like this. But here's the catch. As hard as we try to find this kind of greatness, as we try to find this true love in someone or in a leader, it always seems to elude us. It's like grasping. It's like trying to pick up Jell-O with toothpicks. And we just know that they're people. And people let us down. And they disappoint us. And some of us are very aware of that right now, and this can wreak havoc on our inner person and destroy our ability to experience joy. It can produce in us something called foreboding joy. And I'm going to finish up with this snapshot here, foreboding joy. I hope this will serve us, because I think that we all, as a church family, are at the risk of potentially being overcome by something called foreboding joy. I was doing some reading about this separately, and I'm going to share some of what I've learned from this about foreboding joy. These are not my original ideas, but they've been very helpful. What is foreboding joy? If you're afraid to lean into good news, I'm reading here, quote, if you're afraid to lean into good news, wonderful moments, and joy, if you find yourself waiting for the other shoe to drop, you're not alone. It's called foreboding joy. And most of us experience it. When we lose our tolerance for vulnerability, joy becomes foreboding. No emotion is more frightening than joy because we believe if we allow ourselves to feel joy, we are inviting disaster. We start dress rehearsing tragedy in the best moments of our lives in order to stop vulnerability from beating us to the punch. We're terrified of being blindsided by pain, so we practice tragedy and trauma. But there's a huge cost. When we push joy away, we squander the goodness that we need to build resilience and strength and courage. But the good news? Research has shown that everyone who showed a deep capacity for joy had one thing in common. They practiced gratitude. In the midst of joy, there's often a quiver, a shudder of vulnerability. And rather than using that as a warning sign to practice imagining the worst-case scenario, the people who lean into joy use that quiver or that shudder of fear as a reminder to practice gratitude. But that will take faith for us. It will take faith. So in what ways can we practice gratitude today? For what do we have to be grateful for today? And this is what I want. We'll conclude with this. We can be grateful that we have a king who weeps. We can be grateful that we have a king who wants us. And we can be grateful that we have a king who loves us to the end. Jesus is the leader we all wish for. He is the one you truly seek. He is the true king. In all of your efforts for true love, in all of your efforts for friends, in all of your efforts to find a leader, somebody who you can really follow, this hero, Jesus is the one you ultimately seek. He is the perfect fullness of kindness and courage. He is the perfect fullness of bravery and humility. He has all of that together in perfection. And so you say, where do we find a true king for all that we need or want? We find this in Jesus. And so I'm going to close with this beautiful depiction of Jesus that we're given in Revelation. It's, well, for me, it was breathtaking. This picture that Revelation gives us of King Jesus here, right? We're here in Luke, but let's go all the way ahead to the end of the story. What does this king look like at the end of the story? In Revelation 5, you have John, who's recording this, and he is seeing this vision of this throne room, of this the glory of God, and there's this, it says, then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. John is weeping. There's like this hopelessness in him. And the elder says, do not weep. Look, the lion from the tribe of Judah has conquered so that he is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. So Jesus, this lion, is strong enough and worthy enough to open the scroll and the seven seals. He's worthy. But then in the next verse, John says that he looked for that lion, where the elder said, look. And in verse 6 it says, then I saw one like a slaughtered lamb standing in the midst of the throne. And so John is told there's a lion. Take comfort. There's strength and power and worthiness and fierceness. And then he looks for the lion, and what does he see? He sees a slaughtered lamb. And so the Jesus that we celebrate on Palm Sunday, we look for a lion and we see a lamb. And then we look for a lamb and we see a lion. And you know why that is? It's because the lion and the lamb are the same person. That's the king we have. That's the king we celebrate today. The lion who is a lamb and a lamb who is a lion. We have a king who weeps. We have a king who wants you. And we have a king who loves us to the end. I'll ask the music team to come and get ready. And I'll ask the rest of us just to bow our heads for a quiet moment of reflection, of prayerful response to God about who we have as our king. And I will close us in prayer before we sing.